Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashbery. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1183 features stories from two new writers, Si Fong Chung and Tin Ling Chung. Over the past 3 weeks, we've heard the whole Life Rattle library of Kwai Lee's recordings, drawn from the stories you will find in her recently published collection titled The Palm Leaf Fan. Kwai introduced us to the intricate structure of the minority Hakka community in Kolkata, India, where she grew up. The background of her early life is this small community perched at the edge of rival national politics. This Sunday, we are introducing two new authors from this very same heritage. Si Fong Chung, with her story Alfie, takes us to Tangra, where the Hakka operate many tanneries. Chung paints a metaphor for the striving of the whole community by focusing on one young man's determination to overcome personal adversity. Then Tin Ling Chung will transport us to Canada, where a young woman comes to truly recognize all the sacrifices of her mother's life in Calcutta, which have made her own life here in Toronto so rich with comforts and the love that three brushstrokes will communicate. Our first story is from Si Fong Chung. Chung is a wife, mother, accountant, and now writer. The eldest of five children, she was born in 1958 to Hakka Chinese parents in Calcutta, India. At 18, she immigrated to Canada, where she married and raised three sons. Chung returned to school after her first child was born, and by the time she was 30, earned an accounting designation. 10 years later, she added an executive master's degree in business administration to her resume. Si Fong Chung now spends most of her free time writing, blogging, traveling, and is a volunteer instructor for spinning. That's a form of studio cycling at her local YMCA, where she works out every day. Let's listen now as Fong Chung reads her story, Alfie, here on Life Rattle. And you're listening to Life Rattle from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And please be advised that Life Rattle stories often contain language and situations that some listeners may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
Alfie by Si Fong Chung. Alfie was at the front door again, hawking his mother's chicken giblet and egg stew. A couple of times a week, he would come by our house just before dinner time. He purveyed his mother's cuisine of the day, contained in a smoke-blackened pot, held over the crook of his arm in a makeshift cloth sling. He could not go home until all the food was sold. The Hakka Chinese community in Dhapa, Calcutta, considered Alfie a dimwit. In my mind, he is perpetually 13. He looked the same whether he was a teenager or many years later an adult, with his crew-cut hair that emphasized the odd shape of his head, wide, flat at the back, and slightly rounded on top. He walked with a slouching, ape-like gait, his arms swinging vigorously. In our small, close-knit, leather-tanning community, all the Dhapans knew that Alfie's mother treated him with extreme cruelty. The elders felt sorry for him and bought his wares to save him from his mother's wrath, while the kids tormented him as children are wont to do when presented with an easy target. On that hot evening, when even the dogs flopped on the floor, reluctant to stir the still, humid air, grown-ups and children sat at our front door, waiting for a stray breeze. The concrete benches on both sides of the 6-foot-wide entrance were full. Mrs. Lee, our next-door neighbor, and cousin Fu Han sat on wicker stools in front of the benches. Mrs. Lee perspired profusely. She looked uncomfortable. In her bright traditional Chinese cotton pajama top that buttoned from below her double chin down diagonally to the side. "Alfie's here," she said. "Hey, Alfie, do you have enough stew in that pot for my dinner tonight?" Dinner was an easy affair at the Lee household that night. Alfie's mother would be pleased with his efforts that day. Alfie's appearance was a welcome diversion. He provided comic relief and distracted everyone from the oppressive heat. He sidled up to Papa, who towered over me as he tried to steady my 5-year-old body from toppling with the effort of balancing on top of his feet. "Uncle, can you buy me an ice cream bar, please?" Alfie pointed to the ice cream vendor who stood guard over his treat-filled cart. Papa had a soft spot for Alfie, but he also liked to make him work for his treats. "I'll tell you what, if you sing us a song, then I'll buy you an ice cream. You can pick any flavor you want." "But I don't know how to sing." Alfie pretended to be shy. We all knew how much he loved to sing, despite his tuneless performances. Everyone chimed in, wheedling him to sing. Alfie cleared his throat and launched into a popular Cliff Richard song from the 1950s, "The Young Ones." "The young ones, yowie yowie young ones." He did not know the lyrics, nor did he know any English. Yet, he sang happily with a booming voice and with a total disregard to the melody. Everyone doubled up in laughter. Fu Han, my teenage cousin, whose wide grin always showed a huge gap between his front top middle teeth, howled so hard he fell off his stool. One evening, when I stayed at my grandparents' house, which I did quite frequently, I stood at a window that overlooked the courtyard where Alfie lived. I saw him tied to a wooden post, the dim yellow light from the overhead naked bulb shining on his slouched frame. He stood barefoot with his head hung low over his chest as he cried. 3 or 4 chickens clucked and pecked at the grains scattered on the ground around Alfie. As I watched, his mother came out with a cane. Twack! She lashed him on his hands and legs. The birds dispersed, squawking and protesting. Alfie cried out as the cane came down, one blow after another. He twisted and writhed. I ran to find my grandmother, Popo, to tell her what I saw. When I found her at the back of the house and told her what was happening next door, she sighed. She asked me to stay in the house, then disappeared. I ran back to the window. Alfie's mother was still yelling and cursing at him, getting more and more agitated with each whack of her cane. Popo walked towards Alfie and his mother. She pleaded with the irate woman to stop beating her son. Finally, she put the cane down. Popo untied Alfie as he continued to cry. She helped him to a chair and left to get a glass of water for him. Meanwhile, his mother stood at his side, cursing and bemoaning her fate at having to bring up an idiot child. I could not comprehend why Alfie's mother was so mean to him. As soon as Popo came back to the house, I asked her, "Why does Alfie's mother beat him like that?" "Don't ask silly questions," Popo looked sad. "You are too young to understand all of this. In our community, nothing was kept secret for long. When others heard about this incident, they clucked and they tut-tutted. Should someone talk to Alfie's mother? What a wicked woman! But no, it wasn't anyone's business what his parents did. Besides, wasn't this bound to happen since Alfie was an adopted child? The community only intervened when the punishments meted out in front of them. All the kids teased Alfie. Everyone laughed at his stupidity. Alfie didn't try to fight back. He laughed with everyone. His name became synonymous with silly behavior. Adults admonished us not to be Alfie-like when we acted foolishly. Occasionally, the teasing took a nasty turn when teenagers sometimes got carried away with their pranks. On a hot, lazy afternoon, when all the adults were taking their midday naps, a number of boys went to cool off in a pond, murky with chemicals dumped from the surrounding tanneries. Although the boys tried to dissuade Alfie from joining them, he jumped into the water after them. One of the boys hid Alfie's trousers in a nearby bush. When he emerged from the pond, he could not find his pants. The boys laughed at his distress. When Alfie went home without his trousers, his mother beat him with a belt. Alfie never developed mentally beyond the teenage stage. It was rumored that he had been a smart kid, but had become an idiot because of the numerous blows he took to his head at his mother's hands. He was said to have excelled at his studies when he attended the local Chinese school. He could write his name in Chinese in strong, legible handwriting, and he could read without hesitation. But strangely, no one could confirm that he was ever enrolled at the school. Alfie's parents passed away within a year of each other when he was about 20 years old. He began to insert himself into every event in the community. He appeared at weddings, birthday parties, and wakes. He was everywhere, at the daily outdoor marketplace or at the New Market, a shopping center in central Calcutta, and doing small chores for anyone who would let him help in exchange for a meal or a gratuity. Alfie couldn't find a regular job because no one thought he had the mental capability to be trusted with adult responsibilities. He eked out an existence running errands and helping shoppers carry their loads or wiping down their cars and scooters while the owners shopped. We often bumped into him hanging around the parking lots at the New Market. He would come up to my mother and say, "Auntie, don't worry about your car. It's safe here. I'll look after it." Not that the car needed any extra attention, but it was his way of asking for a tip. He often annoyed me. He would come up to me and say, "Sister, let me help you with your bags." It didn't matter that I was only holding one tiny bag. The more I ignored him, the more doggedly he followed me around, asking me to let him help. Only when I gave him some money would he stop pestering me. He depended upon the community's charity to keep him from starving. A few times a year, some kind souls bought Alfie an outfit or two. He would then look presentable at the Chinese New Year celebrations and at wedding parties and funerals where he helped with the chores. When he turned 40, Alfie's life took a different turn. A Buddhist monk gave him a job as a temple caretaker. He was well suited for the job. All his life, he had helped people clean and run errands. The job involved dusting and sweeping the temple floors and helping the worshippers with their offerings, carrying them from the parking lot to the altar and then back. After the temple patrons completed their prayers, they would leave him some food and a tip. Alfie had finally turned into a man.
That was Alfie, written and read by Fong Chung. Our next writer tonight is Tin Ling Chung. Tin Ling Chung was born in 1970 in Calcutta, India. She went to a missionary school as a World Vision-sponsored child in her early years. Her parents owned a restaurant before moving to Toronto, Canada. Chung met her husband Henry in Toronto and was blessed with a son, Nathan. Tin Chung is a member of Toastmasters International. When she's not writing, she works as an emergency planning coordinator and a realtor. So let's listen now as Tin Ling Chung reads her story, Three Brushstrokes.
Three Brushstrokes by Tin Ling Chung. I run up the stairs in my parents' two-story house in Scarborough when my mother calls out, "Your bath is ready." Mother insists I take a half-hour bath on the eve of my wedding day. There isn't much for me to do as I sit in a tub filled with brewed pomelo leaves, oolong tea leaves, and dried jasmine flowers. I can't believe I gave up going out with my friends for this. Concern about the tea staining my skin vaporizes as the floating dried jasmine flowers spring back to life. I stir the water with a five colors face cloth mother told me to use. I deeply inhale the musty fragrance of the oolong tea. Slowly, I begin to relax. The water cools. Reluctantly, I rinse off the tea leaves and wash my hair. I come out of the washroom and see my mother sitting on my bed. I am surprised to see that she has turned on all the lights since she and father views this as wasteful. Mother has tidied up my room except for my dresser, cluttered with makeup, jewelry, tissues, and knickknacks. She pats the neatly made up bed. She looks tired. I sit down next to her and let her pull the towel off my head. She brushes my long hair. It is a slow and painful process. The tea bath is meant to cleanse me from evil misfortune, and the five colors cloth represents vibrancy and literally translate as the color of a woman. The hair brushing is a rite of passage into womanhood for Hakka brides. It is a family tradition passed on from mothers to daughters, generations after generations. Mother tells me the story of the evening before her own wedding and how my grandmother, Apo, had prepared a tea bath for her and combed her hair under a coconut tree as the sun set inside the courtyard of a home in Tangra, India. She tells me of her parents and of her own childhood. Apo grew up in China and was highly educated in Chinese. My grandfather, Akung, on the other hand, grew up in India and graduated from an English language school with no Chinese education. It was an arranged marriage with many differences in views and customs. Apo used to say, "We were like a chicken and a duck." When mother was only 7 years old, Akung passed away. Life became very difficult. Apo had to take in laundry to earn an income to raise her 9 children. She could not speak the local languages of Bengali, Hindi, and English. Rice bowls were often half empty and stomach half full. I think about my Apo for a moment and remember that she had never worn a ring on her hard-working, wrinkled hands. Traditionally, in Hakka culture, inheritance is only passed on to males. The only part of the family wealth a female takes is the dowry or gold she received on her wedding day. Mother was the youngest and the last daughter to marry. Apo could only give her 3 gold rings as her wedding dowry. With so many children to raise, it was all she could manage to save. Mother's wedding gown was borrowed, only a veil, and her wedding shoes were bought for her. I look at my dressing tables filled with gold, diamonds, and rubies, all laid out for my wedding day. I know there will be more gifts of jewelry from relatives after tomorrow's tea ceremony. I look at my wedding dress hanging inside my closet and at my red evening gown in a garment bag for the wedding party. I wriggle to get out of my mother's grasp and out of the conflicted emotion raging inside. "Sit still," orders mother. "You have the best hair of all my children. Your hair was at least 2 inches long the day you were born. You must never cut your hair." It takes a while for my mother to detangle my long hair. My eyes well up as mother imparts her wisdom on life. With every knot she encounters in my hair, mother gently untangles it. With each long stroke of the brush, mother tenderly tells me to be a good wife and to look after your family. "Marriage is about respecting your husband," she says. In my heart, I know mother refers to obedience. Mother raised me the way she was raised, with a strict family code that requires obedience. This code is a challenge for both of us that started when I was very young. I wanted to do more and to be more, both inside and outside of our house, than what I was allowed according to the family norms, where the male is the dominant head of the family. This belief requires women to obey their fathers before marriage and their husbands after marriage. Widows must obey their sons. I am amazed that despite us both being women, our views on this matter are so different and so apart. How do I tell mother that I desperately want to be a strong, independent career woman? I can tell from the tone of her voice that what she says is not up for discussion. Mother continues, no matter what happens down the road, always remember that it is a prestige to have a husband. She told me of the difficulties Apo had in society because she had no husband and she rarely attended social events. Don't bring shame to the family by treating your marriage like changing your clothes. You are going to marry for life, she insists. With a strict tone in her voice, Mother reminds me, you are the most educated one in the family. Your children should always come before everything. Mother has been there to guide me through every difficult part of growing up, from sicknesses to heartaches, and expects me to do the same for my children, her grandchildren. Sacrifice is the ultimate duty of a woman, Mother declares. I do not ask about her sacrifices because I know that her life has been about hardship and raising her children. She consigns everything to life luck, meaning fate and destiny. Any hardship that comes along is a blessing for a woman to demonstrate that she has born energy, meaning self-determination. Mother tells me how Apo often went hungry and yet did not give up any of her children for adoption. You are my bones and flesh. I can't give any of you up, Apo told her many times. With a not so subtle knock on my head with a hairbrush, Mother tells me, do not answer back to your mother-in-law. You have to save my face, and demands I say okay even to that, before she continues. My biggest fear is that your mother-in-law, complaining that you have no cacao, no family training in values and traditions. Traditionally, when a daughter marries, a Hakka mother gives 3 blessings with the final 3 brush strokes on her daughter's hair. Mother first brushes from the top of my head to the end of my hair and blesses me with a long marriage from beginning to the end. With her second stroke, Mother blesses that I grow old with gray hair together with my future husband. With the third and final stroke, Mother blesses me with many sons and daughters. She then takes a clip from her own hair and clips mine up. She tells me that this is to make sure that all her good blessings are safely received and accepted upon my head. With head bowed, I can't stop my tears when Mother starts to cry. I raised you up under such hardship, and now I have to give you away. I stand up from the bed and look in the mirror at our reflections. I see Mother wipe her tears. I see in myself a woman fortunate to start a new life in Canada with opportunities Mother never had.
That was Tin Ling Chung reading her story, 3 Brushstrokes. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1183. I recorded Si Fong Chung and Tin Ling Chung reading their stories. My name is Virginia Ashbery. Life Rattle returns next Sunday night with more stories. Life Rattle is produced from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.